Welcome to the Conscient Conversations podcast. I'm Nigel Stevens, and in this podcast, I interview key people working in the data center, technology, and telecommunications industries. We discuss their stories and get their insights on the rapidly changing technology landscape. Welcome to the Conscient Conversations podcast. Today I'm here with Professor Vic Baines, who is a cybersecurity and tech policy researcher. Good morning. Great to meet you, Vic. How are you?
Hi, Nigel. It's lovely to be with you today. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. I'm fascinated, Vic, about how you've come to be where you are, and I'm very interested in your story. You've built an extraordinary career. You're at the intersection of technology, ethics, and policy. How did that journey begin, and what drew you to the world of cybersecurity?
Well, Nigel, I'm very conscious that we only have a certain amount of time for this recording. And, you know, I fill entire days, entire workshops with my life story because of how self-important I am. There's a very short, very flippant answer, which is I found myself to be entirely unmanageable and entirely unpromotable. There's a more serious answer that my mother would approve of more, and that is that I just find so many different things very interesting. And there's always, particularly in technology, we wake up to a new news story every single day, don't we? A new cyber breach or a new policy controversy or new advances in a particular form of AI. So I've never got bored in this space. How I got there, okay, it's a little bit of an unorthodox route. A classics PhD on Roman poetry is not the obvious starting point to be working in cybersecurity and on tech policy. But I had a very interesting interview with somebody who was working at the University of Manchester in their futures thinking department, so taking people through scenario building. And this was when I was working at Europol, so this is still a good 15 years ago, before I went to work for Facebook and the likes of that. And he took me right back to my PhD. My PhD was on Roman satire. So if you imagine Private Eye, but it's 2,000 years old and it's in hexameter verse. Of course it is. And he said, oh, but hang on, what were you working on? And I said, well, how Rome was represented as being the most dangerous city on earth. It was so dangerous that it was like being in Troy on the night of its destruction. Right. And so we've all watched all of those movies, you know, particularly kind of Brad Pitt as Achilles and all of that. And it's the sword and sandals stuff. And he said, so hang on a second. So even for your PhD, when you were working in a totally different field, it was all about security rhetoric and how we communicate danger. I said, yeah. And he said, okay, and what do you do now? Well, I work for the European Cybercrime Centre, writing threat assessments for the European Union on how cybercrime is changing the threat landscape. He said, right, and we're here talking about futures thinking. What are you doing in futures thinking? Well, I'm thinking about how security threats and safety threats are going to change in 20 or 30 years' time. He said, so basically, whatever you've worked in, whatever different sector or field you've worked in, you have always been working on security and safety and representations of it. And honestly, until he had said that, the penny hadn't dropped with me that that was somehow what I was motivated by. But yeah, I read a classics degree. I did 3 degrees in classics. Came out of that and thought, okay, now what? And I just randomly in my local newspaper saw an advertisement to be an intelligence analyst. And I went for that. I didn't even know what that was, right? Because we didn't have a pipeline through to intelligence analysis in law enforcement. I went for that job. I became a drugs intelligence analyst in Surrey Police. This is, 20 years ago. And from there, I got to do these incredible sideways moves. And I think we always represent sideways moves as a negative thing, hence my flippancy, you know, that you get moved sideways onto a special project if you're useless at what you do or if you're a pain in the backside to everybody else. For me, it was an opportunity to get to learn something new. So I was seconded onto a mobile phone live trace missing persons investigation. And that was how I got the skills to do, you know, data analysis of telecoms. And, you know, then I became, oh, well, Vic's the phone person, so we can put her on cybercrime. Vic understands IP addresses, so we can get her doing that data. And so from there, I ended up in what's now the National Crime Agency, what was then the Serious Organised Crime Agency and their Child Protection Command. So then when I moved to Europol, I was the person who understood cybercrime and online safety. So then I said, well, OK, why don't we do a new EU threat assessment, which is still going now, which I'm very proud of being the person who originated that. And then from there, having been the person in the European Cybercrime Centre who helped to set up that threat analysis function, but also strategic outreach to all of those telecoms companies, apps, platforms, etc., you know, the big four, big five tech companies, it was a natural step to say, well, why don't I be the person in Facebook that manages all of those relationships with law enforcement? So the people that previously had been my colleagues then effectively became my clients for things like data requests, flagging safety concerns, policy issues. And that took me then into that much wider tech policy space. It might be a strange move for some people to say, okay, well, you know, Facebook, very lucrative job, but also a 24/7 job working things like terrorist attacks, missing children. Because, you know, who's going to say, oh, I'm sorry, I only work these hours. If a child goes missing outside of 9 to 5, I'm not going to work it, you know. So it's a limited job in the sense of there's only so many years you can do that job and keep your sanity, I think is a fair way of putting it. It does take a bit of a toll on your personal life, on your family life. And I also noticed this gap, a gap at the time, round about 2015, 2016, between what tech companies were saying about safety and privacy and cybersecurity and what governments were saying about those issues and about who was responsible for them. And almost to the point where you could see tech companies and governments, firstly, briefing against each other, and secondly, talking past each other in a way that it didn't always seem to involve the users of those services. So if we take an issue like something like end-to-end encryption, it's a key hot button issue. Should our messages be private? And under what circumstances should governments be able to access those messages? Should companies be able to access those messages? Very rarely do we actually ask people what they think about that. And I think the assumption is made that they're not smart enough technically to understand how encryption works, for instance. And so in 2017, I decided to take a step back, go back to research, and rather than working on Roman poetry, to be able to say, okay, well, how does this gap exist? And why don't we involve members of the public in this? So I wrote a book all about how we communicate security issues and danger and how we frame that, particularly how we frame that in the wider concept of technological developments, the history of technophobia and the like. And round about that same time, I was put in an extraordinary position where I could be a Gresham professor and directly engage with the public on these issues. So, I mean, it's been a fantastic journey in the sense of I've always had something really, really interesting to think about. And I suppose having worked in lots of different sectors means that I can appreciate the different perspectives. I totally understand, for instance, why governments want access to people's private messages. I also totally understand the imperatives of big tech companies. And so I like to think that I have a bit more of a holistic appreciation of some of these knotty problems, some of which, you know, are the like that we haven't had to face before.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed, you mentioned a ton of things there, but one thing stood out for me, and this may be a very, very obvious question, but I'd love to hear your answer. We hear more and more all the time about different cyber threats from different states, from criminals. We've seen it affect us with Marks and Spencers and all these kinds of things. Why has it got so much worse?
Now that's interesting, because I think it presumes that it has got much worse. Now, and that's not to minimise the scale and the extent of the threat at the moment. I mean, we could talk for a number of hours just answering this question, but I think one of the things that I frivolously now refer to as Bayes' theory, just because I don't see it out there enough, so I'm claiming it for myself, not in any verifiable legal sense, obviously, is that technology always develops. There will always be people out there who want to harm other people and other people's assets. And so it stands to reason that whatever technology is available, those people will want to make use of that technology and misuse that technology to get, you know, profit, or to make a point, or just to harm other people. And I think some of the policies that are being introduced at the moment are done on the basis that we can eliminate crime. That it, what we hear a lot these days is, well, tech companies, if they wanted to, could eliminate fraud. Well, could they? I mean, society's not done a brilliant job of that since its inception. What we've certainly seen, and again, this isn't to kind of minimise the threat that we see at the moment, but what we've certainly seen is digital technology is an amplifier of all sorts of threats, whether that is fake news and disinformation, or sowing discord within societies. And part of that now, of course, is that individuals have broadcast tools in a way that they didn't have, even really in the last century. That we all have a public platform now, so we can all amplify disinformation or amplify somebody's extreme views or express our own extreme views. But also that with connectivity comes technical exposure. So, you know, as soon as all of our banking went online, you know, one of the things that I was absolutely fascinated by when I was working at Europol is, we had been working, or some of my colleagues had been working for many, many years on armed robbery gangs. You know, jewellery robberies and the like. Now, these things do still happen. But if I think about the cop shows that I grew up with, the Sweeney was all about bank robberies, wasn't it? Even the professionals had, although it was kind of more intelligence related, it had things like people, the dangerous people with the weapons were bank robbers, or they were, you know, members of Irish dissident groups. So, you know, bank robberies, jewellery robberies, physical thefts have fallen off a cliff, because it's so much easier to get into somebody's bank account by duping them into giving you access, or by hacking into their account by reusing a password that's been compromised and has been on a website as, you know, having been compromised and sold on, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we've seen those shifts, not least because everybody's connected now. And equally that we have built up address books that can then be used to target other people. So you get into my web-based email account and you have access to everybody else's data as well. So I think there are many more digitally mediated attack vectors. And this increases and increases. So, you know, if we think about, you know, some of the world's most popular platforms now, like TikTok, and I'm not saying it's an especially bad platform, but it is an especially popular platform. You know, it's an incredible means to display a kind of lifestyle that may or may not be fictional. But you can easily influence somebody into buying a product. That also takes us into a really interesting space that I'm kind of quite exercised by at the moment. When I first started out analysing cybercrime, you know, we had anti-spam coalitions, and spam was absolutely a bad thing. Of course, we all have junk email folders for things like that that are obviously shady or obviously criminal in intent. But spam then became the default method of advertising that we all signed up for, what's known now known as zero party, isn't it? Or first party advertising. And we're effectively saying, oh, yes, you can send me loads of spam for things that I may or may not want. Sign up to our newsletter. And so I think it's affected in terms of the cyber threat, in terms of what we would absolutely say is criminal intent. But it's also changed the landscape of how we interact with brands and how we divide that in our minds, and whether we divide that in our minds at all is one of the things that really interests me at the moment, because it takes us into that space of what is trust now.
No, that's fascinating. I want to move on to something that I think is incredibly relevant, and incredibly relevant for a woman in technology. It's been so male dominated. I mean, I'm a good bit older than you, but in my entire career I've been surrounded by men of a similar age doing the same things, and I'm very interested in what challenges you faced as a woman building a significant leadership role in cybersecurity, and I hope that you've seen some changes over time, but I'm very interested to hear.
Thank you very much for asking that as a question rather than telling me, because actually one of the most significant experiences I've had in that respect was, and I won't name any names because that would be unkind, but I was in a situation in one job that I had where I felt I was being treated unfairly because I was doing more work than somebody else and they were getting the credit for it. Now, that's not necessarily a gendered thing. I think many of us have been in that situation. And I was explaining this to a former boss of mine, and who happened to be male. And I was explaining my frustrations, and the response was, but you know what, Vic? You have to acknowledge that things have got so much better for you women. And I think it was one of the most curious things that I'd experienced, because I did turn around and say to him, right, so you're questioning my lived experience of this. And I think that's quite a curious thing when it comes to being a woman in a particular industry, whether that's tech, whether it's law enforcement. You could call that kind of a double whammy in a way, to go, you know, into law enforcement, then into tech. But it's... You know, I would think about, you know, other protected categories, and how many other circumstances would someone feel it was okay to listen to someone's actual experience and then tell them that that was invalid and they weren't right about it? Imagine getting away with that with, you know, someone because of their ethnicity or any particular disability that they had. But we seem to think it's kind of all right to do that with women, and to do the whole kind of calm down, dear, routine. This is something that I still experience. I still chair meetings where someone will shout me down and tell me my own business. So I think it absolutely has improved in terms of access to the industry. And when I've been teaching at universities and doing external examining at universities, I am hugely encouraged that there are hundreds and thousands of young women coming through on cybersecurity degrees. I think this is fantastic. You know, in your question, you referred to my leadership role, and that's hugely flattering, and thank you very much for that. Whatever leadership role I have, and you might call it, I don't know, thought leadership or something like that, what it isn't is a formal leadership role. I am not a chief information security officer in the cybersecurity industry or in a bank or a VP of anything. And that's because of all of those sideways moves that I've made. I've had to create my own brand and create my own career. At times that's been frustrating because, you know, you can go into a meeting, and as has happened to me some years ago, to go into a meeting and definitely because I was the only woman in the room, I was asked to take the notes. You know, I mean, thank goodness I wasn't asked to make the tea. But, you know, but there is still that presumption, I think, that if you come in, you'll be the nice cooperative one that will make everybody feel nice and warm and fluffy so that they can do their big manly things deciding, you know, issues that you're probably the expert on. But never mind, you know.
I was wanting to say it's hard to believe that, but I'm afraid it isn't.
It isn't. And I worry about this sometimes because, for instance, if there's a young woman listening to this who's thinking about whether this is the industry for them, I don't want to put them off. But, you know, in the last few years, I've been at conferences where, certainly in one case, I was asked to step out and coach a young woman onto the stage who was due to speak but had had a crisis of confidence because she felt so intimidated by the people in the audience. It was largely a male audience. And I do have advice for those people. And it is, you will always be the most knowledgeable person in the room about the thing you work on and the thing you've been asked to speak about. So it really is about encouraging everybody starting out in the industry, but particularly women, a business coach would say, to occupy space, to give themselves permission to take up space and to say, no, do you know what? I know about this stuff. And I'm quite fortunate in that, you know, my education was such that I was the second female head prefect at quite an established boys' school. And the first female head prefect, it was generally agreed that she had not been up to snuff. So there was all to play for here. So at age 17, I came in and went, right, this is how we're going to do things. And I was given permission to do that. You only need one experience like that, and you can feel entitled to just the right level and in just the right way. But I also see it as a duty. And I suppose this is where the leadership role comes in. I see it as a duty to represent. We joke amongst us. There are a few of us who keep getting asked to do the TV and radio, keep getting asked to do the keynotes at the conferences. And we will be told quite openly, and I don't think it's such a bad thing, they'll say, we wanted a woman. And that's great. But it does mean, and I'm exaggerating here, but it does mean there's pretty much only five of us in the country that keep doing all of these speaking gigs, because there aren't many visible women. We are starting to see women come up into leadership roles in tech, in cybersecurity. But what we see is that a lot of them get stuck at middle management level. They fall out of love with it for various reasons. Or, you know, because they need a career break and it's going to be difficult to come back. All sorts of things. But I do feel that if we're not seen, we can't then expect everybody else to stand up for themselves and speak up for themselves.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you. Very much what I expected to hear, but quite distressing in many ways. Thank you for that. You probably know, Vic, that my company, Conscient, is predominantly a data center agency, and we spend a lot of time working in the data center space. It's quickly become, and in fact was recognized recently as being, critical national infrastructure, and that's very important. But from your perspective, if I be your security hat on, if you can look at data centers from your perspective, what are the biggest blind spots that organizations still overlook, or what are the biggest blind spots with data centers, period?
So when it comes to data centers, something that I've been looking at quite recently is the issue of sovereignty. And that used to be quite an old-fashioned word. I think we thought, when the likes of John Perry Barlow came up with, you know, the Declaration for the Independence of Cyberspace back in 1996, saying, you know, your tyranny of sovereignty is not appropriate here because we come from a new age where there's just a single hive mind and the internet is a single common good. Look, that was a brilliant aspiration, but I think what we've seen is that territory and jurisdiction in cyberspace has become more important, not less. And what we're really facing now I'm certainly disappointed that this is the case, but am I surprised? No, not really. It's that we have a kind of new Cold War when it comes to tech powers. And this applies to infrastructure, but it also applies to when we're looking at something like AI. The two big AI superpowers are the US and China. So it is no coincidence that Trump, in both of his administrations, but also Biden to a certain extent, has redefined China as a national security threat and tried to get other countries like the UK, EU countries, to designate it as such as well. So this idea that, you know, we've got two poles in the tech world now, you know, it's not Russia anymore, although they do like to make mischief in the cybersecurity world. But certainly, you know, the US-China polarity. And I think, you know, what we saw with the internet as a whole, but particularly also with infrastructure, is that we built first and then we thought about the security consequences later. Because the tech was developing at such a speed. And all of a sudden, you know, other technology was becoming obsolete. So you had to kind of race to put in the hardware, for instance. And then there were some considerations over, well, one, what if we have Chinese components in our 5G infrastructure? Is that actually a security risk? What kind of security risk is it? Is it espionage? Is it theft of R&D? Or is it just poor security standards? You know, and hence all of that to do around the 5G infrastructure in the UK, US, EU a couple of years ago and ongoing, of course. I see the same developments in terms of data centres in that for the last 10 or 20 years, we've been fairly happy, or lots of people have been fairly happy, to have large US-based technology companies and to a certain extent Chinese-based technology companies hosting their data, processing their data. But what we've also seen with some of these national security concerns is concerns specifically over, okay, where is that data processed? And particularly where we've had the explosion in the cloud market over the last 10 years, I would say. I know we still talk about it like it's new, but let's go back at least 10 years on this one. You know, what we found from an investigative and a law enforcement perspective, and that folks like the Council of Europe drove work on in the last few years, has been, okay, if you're a police officer trying to investigate a crime that's happened on the internet, how do we even know what country to ask? Because you can go to a company and they will say, oh, sorry, but that data's not stored here. Okay, can you tell me where it's stored? No, it's in the cloud. So we have this strange sense of outsourcing what used to be on our premises. We would store data ourselves. We would process data ourselves. And now more and more of the business of tech, both data centers, infrastructure, but also, you know, software, is held somewhere else by somebody else. And the knock-on effect of that from a security perspective is that inevitably we're seeing more supply chain attacks. We're seeing more third-party attacks. If we're thinking about some of the big cyber attacks over the last few months even, you know, we mentioned Marks and Spencer. I'm not a genius in this space. I'm just someone who's quite long in the tooth and been around several cycles of these kinds of cyber attacks. And somebody, you know, said to me, what do you think it is? And I said, I bet you it's a supply chain attack. I bet you they've outsourced something to somebody else. And this is what we see time and again. Now, you know, regulators around the world are not oblivious to this. So we, you know, although we want to think about blind spots, actually, I think it's an area that just needs re-emphasising. So under the Biden administration in the US, he introduced this thing called the Software Bill of Materials. And I love this idea because for the first time it introduces the concept of if you purchase a piece of software from anybody, it has to have something akin to an ingredients list, really. with the provenance of where the different pieces of that software come from. So that, you know, if a piece of that software comes from Taiwan, you actually know about it. Because, you know, what do we know about how data processors and how any company has to regulate its own cybersecurity? It's that the bottom line is they are responsible for it, not the people they outsource to. It's no good when you have a data breach to say to your national data protection regulator, oh, that wasn't my problem because I outsourced it. The buck still stops with you. And we also see that in the European Union as well with the piece of legislation called the Digital Operational Resilience Act, DORA. Acute acronym for short. And that's precisely about that as well. It's knowing where the tools that you are using come from. And so what we're seeing is this general mega trend, if you like, for applying sovereignty in the digital sphere, where it's not just about firewalls, it's not just about controlling the information that citizens see, although of course we do have some very noteworthy examples of that. But it's being able to say the technology that we use is based in our country, or if it's not based in our country, we are always able to conduct our own assurance on it and say, okay, that part is there, that part is there. We've done the security assessment on these people to the best of our ability. We know that they've taken the steps that are required of us by the Information Commissioner's Office, for instance. But yeah, I'm seeing this overarching trend of somehow clawing back control from some of the larger, more amorphous providers. And even to the point that companies like Microsoft are offering these kind of digital sovereign clouds. So this idea that it won't be going off to somewhere possibly in the States or bouncing around the world, your data and your operations, you know, that guarantee that they will be in country, that only certain people will be able to access them, etc., etc. And I think it's good to see a greater concern for security. It's good to see a greater a concern for compliance with the relevant regulations. But it does still present something of a knotty problem. We want a world that has a single global internet, and yet governments still want to be able to have sovereign control. And I think what I'm also seeing is that organisations, companies, processors want to be able to have greater technological autonomy, because more and more, I think, boards, non-execs, trustees are asking the questions, okay, so we process this data, none of it goes through China, right? You know, reassure me that we have oversight over the whole of our estate.
Yeah, no, that's fabulous. And actually, from our point of view, we are seeing those moves, and we are seeing people want to know where their data is, but still commercial advantage seems to trump it. Putting stuff in the large cloud providers is generally less expensive than people's own infrastructure, and they are still tending to trust to that. But definitely a trend. The word sovereign is coming up a lot more than it used to. And I'd like to move on to trust. We've done some work recently with a couple of companies who've been talking about this, and I've learned a lot about trust, and it's not something I'd thought about until recently. But I'd be interested in your view. I think it's a very overused but misunderstood concept. How do you personally define digital trust, and how can organisations make that tangible?
I think it's a lot of different things. So if we go back to, face-to-face trust of doing business with each other, sharing personal information with each other, the keeping of written records, all of those things, a lot of that depends on a personal relationship. When we go into the digital world, what we've seen is that a lot of that still depends on a personal relationship. That's why social media has been until now at least, so hugely successful, but also why the sharing of fake news has been so hugely successful as well. Because when you're in your friendship network on a particular app, you trust the people who are in that network with you. You're less likely to question their motives, the source of the information, etc., etc., to the point that we've actually had to train people to be suspicious in those spaces. And, dare I say, particularly older people. I've done a lot of work in, you know, child protection, youth empowerment over the years. And we've spent a lot of money and a lot of time and effort on that. And that is absolutely right and proper. It's great that we've done that. I do think we have neglected older generations. You know, as much as we can romanticise the time when people left their doors open and nobody ever stole anything. I mean, I think that's exaggerating ever so slightly, isn't it? Crime still happened because people left their doors open. But at the same time, I think there is a trust hangover there, if you like, that particularly with older generations, if they get a call from somebody saying it's your bank or it's, you know, your IT provider, they are much more likely to fall for it. Conversely, I think younger generations who have had the input at school about, you know, online stranger danger, who know full well that influencers are not 100% authentic human beings, in the same way that, you know, we know that when we're watching an advert on TV, it may be staged and, you know, people may want us to think a certain way to buy a certain product. I think conversely, what we have in the younger generation is something of a crisis of trust, because these are people who haven't grown up, I don't know, watching BBC Newsround and knowing that there are certain sources of trustworthy information who will verify the facts before they tell you something. It's a generation that doesn't particularly watch TV, that certainly doesn't get its news on TV. So, you know, I'm, as much as I'm in admiration of services like BBC Verify, I think they're great, you know, and fact-checking services, these actually need to be where young people go to say, you can trust us. I think with younger generations, we have a challenge of how we rebuild trust, how we promote trustworthy information in a way that sticks with them, rather than them just saying, well, I don't trust any of this. And I think they are, it's funny because I think there's an assumption that they are not alert to AI potentially making mistakes and being untrustworthy. I think they are. I think the problem is that they don't trust any of it. Now, we also have, you know, we have organisations like Edelman that do their trust barometer survey, which they've been doing for numbers of years. And I like these. I mean, I think when people are self-reporting, they can also massage what they're saying to you to make themselves look smarter than they are, or whatever. But what we seem to see in as indicators in those kinds of surveys is that members of the public, adult members of the public, distrust governments, companies and the media in equal measure. So it's I think as interesting as it is that we talk about a crisis of trust in technology, and particularly technology companies, and some of that suspicion is very well founded. At the same time, I think there's a problem with trust across the board. And I think when it comes to digital trust, that's because all of those organisations, all of those sectors, governments, tech companies, mainstream media, are using tech in exactly the same way, right? To put a particular point across, to dissuade people from other things, to sell things, whether that's an idea, a policy, a publication, or a product. And criminals use exactly the same techniques. So I did a study a few years back for a book I was writing on security rhetoric and safety communications. And, you know, some of the most interesting research I do is the stuff that surprises me. And there was something niggling in the back of my mind about how the police talk about cybercrime and about how cybersecurity companies talk about cyber attacks and about how criminals talk about the attacks that they're doing against you. And I started to look at phishing emails, but also at those extortion emails, you know, those horrible, horrible ones where it says, oh, I've caught you on webcam doing something horrible. Pay this amount of Bitcoin into this account or I'm going to report you to the police, etc. And even in some cases, when I was working at Europol, posing as the police on the pop-up screen and saying, you need to pay this fine for doing something hideous. And what I found that really surprised me was that cybersecurity vendors were, with a few notable lovely exceptions at the time, were scaring the hell out of people to get them to do something urgently or something catastrophic would happen to them. And law enforcement were representing the threat in exactly the same way and saying, you need to do this, you need to protect yourselves, or something catastrophic will happen. And then that's exactly what you get in an email where a cyber criminal is trying to threaten you to do something. Click on this link, pay this thing, or else. Do it right now. You've got 5 hours, otherwise you're going to be plastered all over the internet. And I thought, that doesn't help anybody. What we actually need to do is explain to people what is going on, how you know, their data is being used in the case of technology companies. So for me, I think, you know, there's some great principles that are developing for artificial intelligence. The OECD have got some lovely principles that, because they're an international organisation, you know, a lot of countries are happier to sign up to, and lots of companies are happy to use these principles. And I don't favour one set over another, beyond the fact that what the good principles for technology and for digital trust emphasise are three things. Of course, I'm attached to safety and robustness, but transparency, accountability, and explainability. And actually, when we think about offline trust, old-fashioned trust, it's about being open and honest with somebody. It's about not hiding something from them. It's about being accountable in the sense that if you make a mistake, you own up to it. And it's also about giving them the benefit and the respect of assuming that if you explain something to them, they will understand it. The challenge we have, I think, in a lot of different areas of technology is that we assume that ordinary people can't understand the technology. And I think this is part of what we're struggling with AI at the moment is, yes, there are some genuine concerns, well-founded concerns, about how well even experts are going to be able to understand and explain what artificial intelligence, particularly generative AI and machine learning, is rapidly doing. So it's keeping the human in that loop. But when it comes to public engagement and civic discourse, policies are being made right now, and it's not always being very well explained to members of the voting public what's at stake and what actually this technology can do and does do. And just as importantly, what it's not capable of right now. You know, and as you will know, there's a lot of hype in the tech world.
There is, absolutely. I think that's fascinating. And we've said for a while that we think that that people who are selling cybersecurity solutions are selling a fear-based sale. It's a completely fear-based, and you're right. Every single dimension of anybody being talked about it is based on fear. But we'll drop that one to move on, if I may. Particularly, I'm interested in the impact of AI. I mean, AI has revolutionised several things and many things in a very, very positive way. We know that governments are racing to regulate that and to understand it. I'm interested in its impact on security in general, and I'm very interested in what I call the unintentionally fake, and that is
see AI drawing conclusions from many different sources of information, some of them fake in the first place, and perhaps even amplifying that. But I'd be very interested in your take on that.
Gosh, there's so much to talk about there. So one of the things in the security space that we do time and time again is we talk about an arms race between the good guys and the bad guys. And I think certainly what we are seeing more of on the market in cyber is automated defence, automated incident response, automated incorporation of threat intelligence and the like. And, you know, that's great. I don't think it puts people like me out of a job because, you know, what we are seeing, gosh, you know, in the last 10 to 20 years, we're seeing a lot of burnout and fatigue in the cybersecurity industry and folks who work in security operations. If you can imagine, you know, you might be getting millions of alerts a day. What do you do with that? And that is where having an automated tool that does the grunt work that you really don't want to put a young threat analyst on, that's where that is really, really helpful to do that automated crunching of different suspicious or even just access attempts and things like that. Flagging and prioritising and triaging, that's great. Because then the humans can be put on the stuff that humans are still really good at, like threat hunting. And also that feeling of what doesn't smell quite right. You know, that idea of, there's something about this. It looks legit, but it didn't feel quite right. So I think there is absolutely a place for automated defence. Are the bad guys using AI? Yes, they are. But you know what? They always have used automation. And I think it is really worth putting that in context. You know, they've been using scripts to mass distribute phishing emails for as long as I've been working on this stuff. One really curious thing that's happened that, of course, I should have foreseen, but I didn't until it was already here, is they're using generative AI tools like ChatGPT to correct their phishing emails so that they don't have grammar and spelling errors in them anymore. And that was one of the ways that we used to train people to say, oh, if the English doesn't look right, if they're pluralising words incorrectly, or if there's, you know, something a bit clunky, now you can write a more convincing phishing email, which means for, in terms of hardening the human defences, preventing people from clicking on stuff, and kind of building their spidey senses, we're kind of losing that ability to do that now. So it really isn't much more about getting them to look at email headers and all of the kind of more technical and process side. Do we think that there is entirely autonomous self-learning malware out there? Well, we haven't seen it yet. But we have seen some interesting things like, you know, poisoning attacks. So skewing the information that AI is trained on so that it comes out with the wrong answer. And you can see how nation states would be really, really interested in those kinds of wrong outcomes. I have one example that, again, came up quite unexpectedly when I was writing a lecture for Gresham College on data. And I wanted to find out, when was the world's first census of population? I thought, okay, there's going to be a definitive answer on that, surely. There'll be something in the British Museum. And I Googled this, and it was in the early days of Gemini AI having, you know, the kind of the top results above all the other results. And it said, the world's first census was conducted by the Babylonians in 3000 BC. Okay, that seems pretty definite. And, you know, I'm a threat analyst. I look at it and I think, 3,000? That's... why 3,000 and not 2,999, right? I thought, this is really definite. Where has this come from? So then you follow the links through and it takes you through to the UK Office for National Statistics, the Australian National Statistics Office, a US NGO that works on statistics and population, blah, blah, blah. Some really official sources. I dug down into those official sources because that's what I'm trained to do. I don't want to be telling the world on YouTube that this is actually the case unless I've been able to verify it. So I'm clicking through all of these links. They all refer to each other. And after, it took me 8 hours to find out this answer. Don't worry, I don't get paid a lot of money for this. It's a good return on investment. When I finally did this 8 hours of research, at the end of that 8 hours, I found in a book that someone who had been the first chief national statistician in Australia in the 1920s had just guessed on the basis that there were some clay tablets in the British Museum that kind of talk about counting people and cows and their cheese producing ability. And what had happened is that because he'd said that, that was taken as gospel. All the other national statistics officers regurgitated that claim. It came to be facts over time, even though there is no verifiable source information for this. And because those were four trustworthy organisations run by governments or trustworthy NGOs, that was the top result that Google gave me, which I could have taken as true. But it was a guess that somebody made in the 1920s. And I think, you know, if that's what's happening with benign information, let's say, you know, tidbits and trivia, then you can see the possibilities for not just manipulation, but unwitting acceptance of things that haven't been verified simply because they come from what we would all deem to be trustworthy sources.
Yes, fascinating. Fascinating. It makes me think of myself listening to the news. And when I listen to the news now, compared to when I perhaps listened to it as a young man, I'm cynical.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this takes us back to this crisis of trust, which is, you know, what's the end point of all of this? The end point is that none of us trust anything. So actually, you know, as much as we can overuse that phrase, tech companies must do more, where I think they do have a job to do right now is to make sure that the source information they're using isn't just verifiable in the sense that somebody said it, but it's verifiable in the sense that it's objectively verifiable. Now, that's no small order, but it is something that I think, you know, as we become more and more reliant on what is that top search result, not just, you know, what I do think we still need to do with everybody, not just younger generations, say, no, read all of the first 10, don't just read the top. But look, this is a world that's moving faster and faster. We're looking at things on our mobiles. We absolutely prioritise convenience over all else. That's the reality of it. So then, you know, what the tech companies can do is that they can have their own researchers digging into this stuff and building tools that just don't just look at the surface. They go deeper as well.
Well, that's fabulous. Thank you so much. We're getting to the end of time. I would like to ask you one more question, but it's been absolutely fascinating. And what I'd like to understand is what's next for you. Are there projects? Are there research areas? Or are there things you particularly want to expand into over the coming years?
Yeah, do you know, there's a number of different answers to that, as I'm sure you're now expecting. The first one is that, you know, you do something like being a Gresham professor, where your sole focus or the bulk of your focus is writing lectures that then go out to hundreds and thousands of people, both in person and online. And that's, I've taken that to be quite a responsibility, because you only really get one shot at those. You can't go, well, that's what I said last year, but I've changed my mind now. You know, you've got to kind of be as authoritative, but also interesting, etc. It takes a lot of work, you know. And so having done 3 years of that, I'm at that a little bit of a crossroads where I think, okay, what next? I've worked in tech companies, I've, you know, worked in government, I've worked in international organisations, I've been an academic. What now? You know, I have cycles in my life where I do something for a few years and I think, okay, what now? So, you know, there's that aspect of, oh, I'm taking a bit of stock. I'm thinking, okay, what can I do that blends all of that now? In terms of specific research areas, for my final year of Gresham Lectures, I did a series called The Prehistory of IT, where we looked at things like, you know, the world's first surviving computer, the anti-Kithara mechanism, where we looked at ancient attempts to sort people using data, and, you know, where we looked at ancient messaging systems, but also some of the controversies. You know, did the Hollywood star Hedy Lamarr really invent Wi-Fi? And you know, spoiler alert, the short answer is, well, kind of, but kind of not. And so really kind of situating the shock that we have at new technology in a history and say, right, no, this is a progression. Some of this stuff hasn't just come out of nowhere. And one of the things that keeps coming back to me is that technophobia has a really long history. We even have, you know, Plato in the Republic recounting an imagined story in which a king says to one of his advisors, who is credited with inventing writing, you know, this writing you've invented, I don't trust it. It's going to ruin people's memories. So that there's the suspicion of the invention of writing as technology, the kind of the very first IT, was suspected thousands of years ago. The idea of it, anyway. So I'm looking at the long history of technophobia. And yes, I'm going to be looking at the Luddites and, you know, things like that. And people's imperatives for being suspicious of technology in exactly the same way that we have automation anxiety now around AI doing away with people's jobs. You know, silk weavers in Spitalfields in the 17th century had exactly those anxieties, you know. But also, the more I think about that long history, the more I think that there are myths that we tell ourselves about technology. That it's always new. That it's either always evil, or it's magic, or it's, you know, neutral. Take your pick. That it's just for boys, and that it's just for boys in hoodies or their medieval equivalent, you know. That it will save us from all of our human problems. And so really kind of digging down into the history of those and saying, you know, for quote unquote ordinary people who are never that ordinary, of course you can understand this. Because if you worked on a weaving loom, or if somebody in your family worked in a cotton mill, they were the computer programmers of their day. Women who can use a sewing machine, anybody who can use a sewing machine, is technical. And I have this, and what really crystallised it for me was I was doing an interview with a magazine for older ladies who like to make things. And the woman who interviewed me said, now you need to explain this in really basic terms because I'm not technical and none of our readers are. I said, whoa, hang on a second. I will absolutely explain it in accessible terms that everybody can understand. But I object to anybody saying I am not technical, given that your magazine gives away dress patterns and knitting patterns, and that the people who read your magazine have probably managed household budgets for most of their adult life. So I'm quite militant about showing people that they can understand technology, and that's kind of, that will keep being my trajectory in some form or other, I think.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Vic. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I didn't think for one moment I'd get an education on classics and history, as well as cybersecurity. But it's been fascinating, and hopefully maybe have you back at some time. You'd never know. But it's been brilliant talking to you. Thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Absolutely, and likewise. Thanks so much for inviting me, Nigel.
No, you're welcome. All the best. Thanks a lot.